Hello and welcome to this Spotlight edition of the Security Ledger podcast, sponsored by Flashpoint. I'm Paul Roberts, the editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. Fresh off a buddy-buddy meeting with Kim Jong-un, the murderous leader of North Korea, Donald Trump's administration moved this week to abandon the UN Human Rights Commission, even as President Trump launched withering online attacks against the government of German Chancellor Angela Merkel. These bizarre twists and turns are just the latest evidence that we're living in unprecedented times. Our longtime friends have become adversaries, if not outright enemies. As for our longtime enemies, well, they're still our enemies too. Central to the unsettling of the global order have been the growing ranks of nation-backed hacking groups and their legions of fellow travelers, including online influencers, trolls, conspiracy theorists, and rabble-rousers. Hacking and other online influence operations have moved to the forefront of nations' arsenals and are one of their most reliable and surgical tools of influence. What lays ahead and how will the unsettling of the global order play out online in the coming months? And what impact will that have on the countless businesses and organizations whose business is done online? That's what the Flashpoint Business Risk Intelligence Report tries to answer. In this special Spotlight podcast, we're going to dig deep into the latest BRI report with John Condra, the Director of Asia Pacific Research at Flashpoint. To start out, I asked John why improved relations with North Korea won't translate into less North Korean hacking activity.
John Condra, Director of Asia Pacific Research.
So if I've got John Condra on the line, then we must be about to see another business risk intelligence report from the folks at Flashpoint.
I think you guessed correctly.
This is your mid-year report. You put out two of these a year. Some really interesting observations. I thought I'd start with the sort of the elephant in the living room, which is North Korea. Our president, Donald Trump, just got back from a summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, a hugely, you know, momentous and I guess symbolic event. Help us understand how this, what we've seen from North Korea in terms of their cyber activities and how the summit is going to affect those, if at all.
Yeah. So I think it's a great place to start. Obviously, this was the big news of the past week or so. And I think a lot of the Asia watchers in particular are still kind of reeling from the aftermath of the summit. I guess I would say that it's been kind of a remarkable 6 months. If you recall the beginning of the year, really when we put out our last report at the end of 2017, the threat of kinetic conflict with North Korea was very real. And you know, you could say more real than it has been in quite some time. And the last few weeks in particular, we've seen this remarkable reversal wherein North Korea seems willing to come to the table. Kim Jong-un has made some surprise trips out of North Korea to China and South Korea and, you know, has recently accepted an invitation to the White House. So, you know, this isn't the first time that we seem to have made a breakthrough with North Korea, but it is the first time we have done so with Kim Jong-un in power. He is not his father. He's not his grandfather. He's Western educated, has a well-known penchant for Western luxuries and media. So, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic that this might be a turning point. The summit was remarkable in that it's the first time a sitting president has ever sat with a North Korean leader. Although a lot of vagaries are still kind of surrounding the agreement that was penned there, we'll see how it goes forward. With respect to cyber activity, we did assess in our previous report that we didn't expect North Korean cyber activity to really fall off anytime soon, and especially that was the case at the time because this kind of rapprochement hadn't happened yet. In the current report that's coming out next week, we make a pretty similar assessment that we don't really think that we assess with moderate confidence that a complete cessation of North Korean cyber operations is unlikely in the near future. And this is really because it's widely believed that North Korean cyber units operate with a degree of autonomy, not even in North Korea per se, the geographical borders of North Korea, and also use their operations to fund themselves. So these groups still need to be funded. They still need to keep the lights on.
Right.
So they have been going after, particularly the last few months, going after South Korean cryptocurrency exchanges. We've seen a slew of reports from South Korean researchers and security community over there talking about breaches and spear phishing campaigns using malware linked to North Korean threat actors, going after Bitcoin wallets, etc. I do think that a large-scale North Korean attack on say, for example, American Infrastructure or, you know, another Sony Pictures Entertainment compromise during this time frame where it does seem like they're trying to turn things around diplomatically for whatever reason. I think that's unlikely because I think that would derail those efforts pretty substantially and probably bring us back closer to kinetic conflict.
It's interesting, this model of the sort of cyber units supporting themselves. My understanding is that in China, that was the model for a long time, maybe not necessarily with Chinese cyber units, but with other military units. And it can create a kind of decentralized organization where different, you know, units are essentially freelancing in order to earn the money to pay their salaries.
Oh, absolutely. With respect to China, that was, I mean, up until the late or the mid 1990s, when the party started forcing the PLA to divest some of its industries, the PLA was very much self-funded. They operated factories, all sorts of different industries that weren't even remotely related to the military per se. It was a way of self-funding and kind of made them autonomous from the civilian political leadership. And that was something that obviously the party was not comfortable with. And so they've drawn that back. But I think that model is probably a little bit more still active in North Korea since the regime is just so much more strapped for cash.
And maybe kind of the corollary of that is that when we hear about these operations against, for example, cryptocurrency exchanges, obviously when we hear that it's North Korean actors, we impart some kind of geopolitical strategy to it, but it may just be trying to make the rent, so to speak, and no grand strategy to it beyond smash and grab.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I guess two thoughts on that point. The fact that they're going after South Korean cryptocurrency exchanges in particular isn't, I don't think that's a coincidence. So I do think that there is a little bit of geopolitical motivation there. Obviously, the South is still, you know, they're still technically at war. So it's their prime target in that vein. But on top of that, it is also obviously a little bit easier, even though North Korean and South Korean dialect is slightly different. It's easier for them to go after Korean speakers because it's easier for them to customize spear phishing messages, for example. So it might be a little bit of geopolitical motivation plus a little bit of just convenience.
I mean, we know that under Kim Jong-un, obviously the country's nuclear program has accelerated and we have seen a lot more from North Korea in terms of cyber activities since he took power. What do we know about their capabilities and how those have developed over the last couple of years, John?
I guess the primary trend to note there is that there's widespread belief that a lot of these groups are now operating no longer in the borders of North Korea geographically, diversifying and moving down to areas like Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, that whole region. And as China has in particular started cracking down on some of their activities, and they closed the Chil So Bong Hotel in Shenyang, where they were believed to have operated from for some years, they are starting to diversify where they operate from. I think there's a few reasons for that. You know, I think that area is relatively cheap to operate from. The governments tend to be a little bit less wealthy, a little bit harder for them to conduct rigorous law enforcement action.
As we look right next door to North Korea's neighbor in China, we're also seeing increased activity. Most recently, obviously, there was the news about the naval warship designs that were lifted from a U.S. Navy contractor and some very advanced and classified designs there. What's going on?
So I guess I want to clarify one thing first. The agreement between Xi Jinping and Barack Obama was explicitly about business information for commercial advantage. It was about commercial espionage, not necessarily national security related espionage. The problem is really that it's becoming increasingly hard to divorce commercial espionage from national security espionage, or what I guess most would consider quote unquote legitimate espionage. It's a contractor, it's a private company, but it's contracted by in this case was the U.S. Navy to build ships for them, for example. Yeah, it's for, you know, those plans will benefit a company in China commercially, but it will also help the Chinese Navy develop countermeasures for whatever systems they may have been developing. So the line is no longer clear. And this has been an evolution as kind of the military industrial complex has grown. It's no longer you can point to, you know, say the compromise of Lockheed Martin where they stole the F-35 plans. You know, you can't truly say that that's commercial espionage, and you can't truly say that it's not. And right. I think that's where we're having trouble drawing the line in that. So, you know, in the case of the contractor you're referencing, unfortunately, to me, that is a target that we shouldn't be all that surprised to see them going after. And I don't see that personally, and this is not the opinion of my company, but personally as a violation of that.
This podcast is sponsored by our friends at Flashpoint. Flashpoint delivers business risk intelligence to empower business units and functions across organization with a decision advantage over potential threats and adversaries. The company's sophisticated technology and human-powered analysis enable enterprises and public sector organizations globally to bolster cybersecurity, confront fraud, detect insider threats, enhance physical security, assess M&A opportunities, and address vendor risk and supply chain integrity. Check them out at flashpoint-intel.com. You know, one of the predictions you make in your business risk intelligence report, it's coming out, is that, you know, the activities, Chinese-related hacking activities may be affected or are likely to be affected by increased trade tension between the U.S. and China. And of course, as we're speaking, the Trump administration has imposed another, I think, $50 billion in tariffs on China in apparent retaliation for intellectual property theft that's taken place. Is cyber going to be one of the avenues through which the government and military of China express their displeasure over these tariffs?
So unfortunately, I don't think it has to be an either or thing. I think we are likely to see an official Chinese policy response, maybe in the WTO, like you mentioned, maybe even in the UN or at least at the ministerial level. It's entirely possible that the anger over the dissolution of the Chinese-U.S., you know, not I want to say free trade because it's never been truly free trade, but the kind of the dissolution of the Chinese and American economic linkages under the current administration may induce them to restart some of this activity. And, you know, I would also say that while the general consensus and kind of that you could probably tell from a lot of the reporting that's come out or lack thereof in this case, it does indeed seem that a lot of the Chinese APT, cyber espionage activity, has slowed since the heyday. And while that's probably still somewhat true, there are some grumblings right now about, you know, we don't actually think they went away. They retooled. They got smarter. They changed their tactics, techniques, and procedures, and they're not going after the big targets anymore. They're going after the small ones and then pivoting, that kind of thing.
And we're just not seeing it, I guess.
Exactly. And it's also that they've been targeting their regional neighbors more so than the U.S. That's another theory that's out there. You've been seeing some stuff against Japan and Taiwan, notably, and some of the Southeast Asian countries as well. So.
What do we know about how nations who are sophisticated about this, China, Russia, are likely to use cyber activities as a tool of leverage?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, you know, the cyber domain provides nation states with a variety of different tools. First and foremost would be just the ease with which you can influence the society or the perceptions of your adversary and the population at large. And you know, I think the most obvious glaring example of this would be what Russia is accused of doing in the 2016 presidential election and what, you know, what they've tried to do in other European elections since and what is suspected to take place in the upcoming midterm elections. So influence campaigns, especially through things like social media and video sharing sites, etc., are increasingly easy, given that anybody can register, and the, you know, they are self-contained in many cases echo chambers, where it's very easy to spread messages that are that can incite some sort of anger or hostility, or, you know, and even at, you know, I think Russia in particular has been playing both sides of the field, both on the left and the right, the US in particular. So I think that is a very effective tool for sowing division within a population that I think is not, I think the Russians are probably the most advanced at it, but they're not the only ones who are capable of it for sure. With respect to malicious cyber activity, I mean, they're able to use hacktivist groups, for example, as well. Both China and Russia have been accused of doing this in the past. In Russia, it's been, you know, Fancy Bear's hack team going after sporting organizations. Mm-hmm. And in China, it's been the most famous one, Chinese Hawker Army, mm-hmm. going after all sorts of different government agencies, financial institutions, etc., for, you know, perceived slights against China. And that, you know, whether or not they are 100% controlled by the government's kind of besides the point. They're at least tacitly supported, at least tacitly allowed to exist in a certain sense. And that provides the government with a little bit of soft pressure, I guess I would call them, and also a pretty significant level of plausible deniability.
One of the interesting observations in your business risk intelligence report is that Russia, which was a very active player in the last year or two in terms of hacking activities, has become fairly quiet. Talk to us why that is, and also whether this is likely to be a temporary or permanent change in their activity.
Oh, okay. So I would say that it does seem that they have been quiet over the last first half of 2018. There was some accusations of Russian meddling in the Italian elections that saw some far-right parties come to power, both, I guess, through some social media campaigns to influence public opinion, as well as some actual direct connections between some of the politicians in Italy and Russian nationals. I do think that they're probably planning to do something very similar to in the upcoming midterm elections in the U.S., in large part because there wasn't a lot in the way of repercussions, frankly, for what took place in 2016. I don't see a good reason why they would not make every effort to kind of protect their potential investment if it is true that they were very much involved in this. The other aspect of this, I think, is that Russia for the last 6 months or so has been focused pretty intensely internally to crack down on dissent. Mm-hmm. They had their own election not terribly long ago, and they've been trying to crack down on internet and services that they don't see as being sufficiently transparent. This includes services like Telegram, which was banned on April 17th, I believe, and as well as blocking some other access to other types of Western services like Google, Amazon, etc. So I think Russia has been also focused internally on building up their own safeguards to keep the population in control and control the domestic narrative.
Russia has conducted some very successful offensive cyber operations and influence operations, online influence operations in recent years, arguably tilted the election to Donald Trump, who is obviously a fan of President Putin's and sympathetic to Russia's interests. On the other hand, the country has paid a very large price in terms of, sanctions and embargoes, and certainly challenges to their economic activity. Is there a moral or lesson in that for countries? In other words, do countries look at maybe the success of the information or influence operations, but also weigh the consequences for Russia economically of those?
Yeah, I think it probably depends on what type of country you're talking about and kind of the economic situation that they're in. I mean, if we're going to use the model of how Western Europe and or the EU and the United States responded to, say, the 2016 election interference, you're right in that sanctions were put on. It obviously had an effect domestically, but at the same time, it didn't change much really on the ground for those in power. It may have put the squeeze on Russian citizens a little bit economically, but Putin got reelected. The price of oil is rising again. And since Russia's economy is so heavily based on energy interests, I think Russia might come out of this not really having paid all that much of a price. And so in that sense, I think it does depend on the type, kind of the specific situation of the country you're dealing with. And for example, in a country like China, I would argue that China is a little bit more sensitive to economic fluctuations than maybe Russia in that sense, or another, I'm trying to think of another good example here, but the Chinese government is the one thing it fears is economic instability, because that just derails the entire kind of agreement, social compact they've made with the populace. So in a country, in a situation like China, yeah, they could certainly engage in something like that. And I think sanctions like the style that are on Russia would have an impact on the Chinese behavior, I believe, but it would also, given how intertwined the economies of the US and China in particular are, it would hurt us as well. But I think, for example, the sanctions can be effective, but it really does depend on the amount of trading you're already doing. If you're not doing any trading, sanctions aren't going to do anything. So I think the sanctions that have been put on Iran in particular have really, I think you've seen with some of the unrest over the last few months in Iran and the plummeting value of the currency, et cetera, it did change the behavior, and it was one of the reasons it brought them to the table to begin with. Hmm.
There's so much speculation about what might be waiting for us in the U.S. midterm elections, which are in November. You follow this space closely. What do you expect to see? Will Russian affiliated groups be active? And if so, where do you think we're going to see that activity? And when do you think we're going to start to see it? Maybe it's happening already. I don't know.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me at all if it was already happening, or at least setting up the infrastructure for it. You know, I do think a lot of it's going to take place in social media. Even, you know, the best efforts of companies like Facebook and Twitter, et cetera, are, you know, they are putting their best foot forward in dealing with this problem. But it's a really intractable problem. It's very hard to stamp out. Just because you have an IP address coming from Russia doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, on these platforms, doesn't necessarily mean that it's a Russian troll, for example, but it very well could be. And if they're smart, they're not going to be using Russian endpoints anyway. So it takes a lot of really just manual labor mixed with automated tools to identify groups or you know, pages on Facebook that have been created by these organizations that are intent on manipulating the election. I think that we're going to see something very similar. And I don't see what would keep them from attempting it, since they didn't really pay much of a price the first time around.
Do you expect to see them targeting voting infrastructure, either at the state, county, local level, come November?
That hasn't really been their modus operandi in the past, if I'm not mistaken. So that would be a little bit of a shift, and I don't think they probably need to. Russia's masters at manipulation to begin with. So I would be surprised if we saw that. But then again, you know, black swans are out there, and you know, I can't, you know, past performance is not a predictor of future results.
You know, we've got a new administration, obviously, and some new thinking about cyber offense. I think a more gung-ho attitude towards cyber offensive operations, but also a lot of friction and tension within what we refer to as the Five Eyes community, the U.S. and its allies. Where does that leave Five Eyes? We've got a U.S. that's maybe more open to doing cyber offense, but allies who are very wary of the U.S. So where are things going there?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess I would say that, you know, I think the relationship between the Five Eyes countries and even some countries that are close allies of the United States but that are not technically in the Five Eyes is stronger than, you know, one administration, one 4-year period, one 4 or 8-year period, I suppose. I don't think that those relationships are likely to be significantly derailed long term. Based on whatever happens in this time frame. I know, obviously, the whole friction with the G7 this past week has been all over the news. But again, I those are longstanding relationships, and it's built on a lot more than you know, just one or two negative experiences. Let's put it that way. I think unfortunately, the United States has really lost a lot of ground in the last 2 years in the intelligence community, and due to the shadow brokers releases and the WikiLeaks Vault 7, Vault 8 dumps, it really has shaken the national security establishment, the intelligence community in particular, to the core. We're seeing, you know, even in the New York Times, there's been a few exposés about morale being very low at the NSA and, you know, kind of a brain drain. I think that's going to take a long time to recover from. And I don't mean just in terms of tactics, techniques, procedures, tools, infrastructure, everything that was lost or exposed due to those breaches, but also reputationally. That really does, that's a lot harder to regain, and it's going to take a lot more time.
You know, final question. It is such an amazing time. I guess amazing has quotes around it, but such an interesting time in terms of geopolitics and a real shakeup of what had been the kind of dominant world order for decades. How do you think all the turmoil that's going on right now is going to impact the cyber realm? Do you see changes already just based on some of the larger geopolitical shifts that we've seen in terms of cyber operations and the types of things countries are considering or even doing online?
So I guess I would say that geopolitics tends to change pretty slowly. A lot of these trends are going to take decades to totally unfold. I do think we're heading into an era of multipolarity, whereas wherein since the end of the Cold War, we've been in one of unipolarity, with the U.S. as the indisputable hegemon, and thus the one essentially writing the rules for everybody else. Multipolar systems tend to be inherently more unstable and prone to, I don't want to say bad actors, but prone to differing worldviews and differing ways of doing business. So I do think that as we go into that, I think the rules of the road are going to change, especially as China grows even more powerful and maybe a resurgent Russia take the stage and do challenge U.S. dominance and values. We could see kind of a loss of some of the core values that we have of, you know, say, for example, the prohibition against commercial espionage. That seems to not be something that the Chinese and maybe to a lesser extent the Russians care about all that much. So as you know, the U.S.'s role in the world is I don't want to say absolutely, you know, in absolute decline, but relative decline, just naturally, I think we might see kind of a value shift in that sense. And that will drive, that will absolutely drive how we, you know, how we have to think about threats coming from these countries.
John Kondra, Director of Asia Pacific Research at Flashpoint, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us on the Security Ledger podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me again, Paul. It was a pleasure.